Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte observes the one-year anniversary of its deadliest day for law enforcement. Charlotte City Council moves forward in their decision to replace Tariq Bakari on that body. Mecklenburg County finds itself back at the center of the immigration debate. An alternative proposal from the town of Matthews over the one-cent sales tax for transit is rejected. A look at the impact of federal funding cuts and policies on the local area and the Spectrum Center unveiled new improvement plans. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News race and equity reporter Julian Berger. Also with us from WFAE, our climate reporter Zachary Turner, to update us on the wildfires in western North Carolina and more. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome back. So let's begin with this.
For the last year, I have asked myself countless why questions. I've wrestled to find answers and logic to uphold where my life currently stands. The many days it still feels like I'm right where this nightmare began, I have worked to realize that not all questions can be answered with reason or fairness.
Ashley Iyer, the wife of CMPD officer Joshua Iyer, who died a year ago this week while arresting a suspect in what turned out to be Charlotte law enforcement's deadliest day ever. She was speaking at the commemoration ceremony for her husband and the three other law enforcement officers who lost their lives that day. Joe, remind us, what happened on April 29th, 2024?
Awful day. A U.S. Marshals Task Force was attempting to serve a warrant on Galway Drive in the Shannon Park neighborhood when the suspect inside, Terry Hughes, opened fire on all of the responding officers. Four officers died. Several more were injured. Police did shoot and kill Hughes that day.
They were there to serve a simple warrant. They evidently didn't expect a shootout would ensue, but that incident has raised a lot of questions about how this could have happened and why the officers serving the warrant on someone they believed to be dangerous were caught so off guard. Have any of those questions been answered?
CMPD conducted an internal investigation to the shooting, and CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings did tell us that they aren't changing any policies as a result of the investigation, which I also think speaks to the quality of, you know, the work that CMPD did do in responding to that very chaotic scene. This, unfortunately, was just a tragic incident where there was a suspect who took advantage of officers in a vulnerable state and was able to hurt and kill several of them.
North Carolina Department of Corrections officers, Sam Peloche, is that how you say his name?
I believe Peloche.
Peloche. And Alden Elliott, who died that day along with Iyer and Deputy U.S. Marshal Tommy Weeks. The U.S. Marshal Service announced it was committed to better protecting task force officers. Those are the people that help deliver these warrants and have invested in training and equipment for officer safety along with incident de-escalation. But they also pledged to conduct an internal review, which remains unfinished. It's been a year. Why?
Well, Chief Jennings told us that their internal review of the incident is closed, and there was nothing that really came out of it in terms of anything that CMPD did wrong during the investigation. Now, I'm not sure if the Federal Marshals Task Force, if they also looked at it from their end. That information I don't have.
And also the North Carolina Department of Corrections looked at it from their end. They lost two officers. They conducted a review of their own, but they have refused to share any records, citing the confidential nature of the report. Why would the report be so confidential that none of it could be shared?
When we get into police matters like this, and, you know, it's not always a big thing like this, big investigation, sometimes it's something very small. There are certain parts of North Carolina records law that protects police information and allows it to be confidential. They also can sit behind a parts of the law that says they don't have to release things that could jeopardize an investigation. So it doesn't totally surprise me that these agencies haven't specifically released what happened. I think oftentimes when we do see that, it's because of either a court order or, you know, just a radical commitment to transparency.
Well, as we've talked about over the last several weeks on this program, City Councilman Tariq Bakari resigned from his seat a couple of weeks ago to take a job with the Trump administration in Washington. And now the council, Mary, is looking for his interim replacement. That person by law must be from the Republican Party because that was Mr. Bakari's party. Is the search now officially underway?
It is. The application opened this Wednesday and is open to any registered Republican who lives in his district, District 6, and is over 21. The plan is to keep the application open for about 2 weeks, at which point city staff will go through, willow out any applicants that don't meet those requirements, and then it'll be in the city council's hands. They plan to hold a public forum for candidates and then ultimately vote and get somebody in office by late May, early June.
So that's the timeline. They voted on a timeline, and that's what they're trying to meet. So Tariq Bakari was sometimes an oppositional voice to some people on council, including the mayor, though he could not be described as anything but a city booster. And that's a role he says he will continue to play even while in Washington. But he texted fellow Republican Councilman Ed Driggs, advising the council to move as fast as possible on finding his replacement. And Driggs did say it would be meaningful for District 6, that's Tariq's district, to have a representative on council during upcoming votes, including one on the city's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. That text and Ed Driggs' response elicited this response from City Councilwoman LaWanna Mayfield.
I respect the fact that our former colleague has a recommendation. That's not his job. Our job is to receive the applications from the community, from the residents who live in the district, who are part of the party that is being represented, and for us to make the best decision that we can.
So Bakari has recommended his wife for the job. I'm sure that she's welcome to throw her hat into the ring, Joe, but how will this new councilman actually be chosen?
Kind of just like you said, they're going to look at the applications and decide who they want to pick. For some reason, these appointments have kind of always had drama around them with Charlotte City Council, not quite as dramatic as Cabarrus County with lawsuits and all the issues that are going on with that appointment. It will just be interesting to see if Krista Bakari clears the field. And, you know, even if just a random person who's not on people's radar applies, if council members will give that person wait just because they don't want to, you know, because there's politics at play. We got election in the fall, you know, there's a lot of things, outside influences to this. It is interesting that Dimple Ejmyra flat out said, though, that she doesn't care if this person runs for the seat or not. I think, though, and I'll wrap up after this, if you want to be the District 6 representative, well, while the budget is presented, you know, you could really get a leg up if you go to all the budget presentations and the debates and stuff, so that way you can really hit the ground running. You won't have the inside baseball. You know, won't be able to call Marcus Jones if you have a question about the budget, but at least you would have the ability to say, hey, I've been to every single budget meeting since this budget has been presented, which will happen on Monday.
Dedication. Mary.
Yeah, as Joe alluded to, I think the question of whether the applicants plan to run for a full term in the fall will definitely be a point of contention in this. It came up during Monday's meeting. The council decided that that will be a question on the application, but folks can respond, prefer not to say. The city attorney also emphasized the city can't legally bind people to their answer. Some folks like Malcolm Graham said they want, the word he used was a caretaker, somebody who will simply fill in for a few months and then step away. Others, as Joe said, like Dimple Ejmyra, said that it won't be a factor for them. So this is something that's come up in past appointment cycles, and something that I think will be a big point in this one when you consider that District 6 is really our only competitive city council district that we have left in terms of both parties putting up strong candidates.
At best, this person would not take office until sometime probably early June, and then there are the elections in November, and council will switch over in December. So this this will be a short tenure, but does anybody who gets this position temporarily, does it give them a leg up? Do they get to put the incumbent coat on?
They will, technically. And the idea is that, you know, at best, it gets you some name recognition, which can be of great value in what could be a very crowded primary field.
Joe.
I think Ed Driggs brings up a good point, too, that it is weird that 10 Democrats are going to appoint a Republican to the seat, considering all of the, you know, political stuff that's going on as well. You know, it's a 9-2 Charlotte City Council, but Democrats would love it to be 10-1. They all did back Stephanie Hand 2 years ago. So I do think political things will be at play here, and Ed is influential. So I do think Ed will be able to sway some council members and really have a big say in who is appointed. But at the end of the day, though, it's very easy for 6 Democrats to put somebody in this seat that maybe won't have a political leg up in a couple of months.
Stephanie ran against Tarek last time and was on this program with him, and it got a little testy. It kind of brought out the best in Tarek, or the worst, depending upon your point of view, I suppose. Aside from Tarek Bakari's wife, has anybody raised their head above the fray? Do we know who might be thinking about running for this or putting their name in the hat?
I haven't heard anyone. Mary, okay. Have you?
Not particularly, no. Talking to a couple of Republican campaign types in the immediate aftermath of Tarek's announcement, you know, I think the descriptors they were using for an ideal candidate were pretty general, but they really, you know, lined up with Krista's resume. Somebody with some name recognition, somebody who has got some personal wealth that they could put behind their campaign, somebody who knows the district really well and the core issues there. So, again, not naming names, but, you know, she certainly kind of fits that bill.
Okay, more to follow in the coming weeks. ICE has been making arrests at courthouses and other government locations where undocumented immigrants are likely to be. They arrested 4 people outside the Mecklenburg County Courthouse last week, 2 of which had business at the courthouse that day. This is part of a new approach toward undocumented individuals being taken by the Trump administration under the direction of Border Czar Tom Homan. Joe, you just came back from D.C. where you spoke with Homan. And Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden's name came up in that conversation. He's had some disputes over the last year or so with ICE. That dispute has been over something called detainers. Talk about detainers.
Yes, the issue that continues. Detainers are basically from ICE saying we have belief that a person that is currently in your detention center is in the country illegally. We're asking you to hold them for 48 hours and give us a call before they are scheduled to be released. So, the sheriff, as we have talked about every week for the last 2 months on this program, does not give ICE a call before the person is released. He does hold that suspect for 48 hours. ICE says that's not good enough. We need to know when this person is going to be released. Homan's basically what his argument comes down to is say, if you care about public safety, give them a call, let them make the arrest at the jail. Otherwise, they're going to go to courthouses and other public areas and make the arrests when they
can. We're going to take a break, but we're going to hear from Tom Homan and part of your conversation with him in a moment. Gary McFadden, the sheriff of Mecklenburg County, says he doesn't notify ICE after 40 hours because he doesn't have to. It's not in the law, and he is a person that allegedly follows the law. We'll talk about that, too, when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Hence, Joe Bruno is here from WSOC-TV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And we have two of our own on the panel today. Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter at WFAE News, and Zach Turner, our climate reporter. Although Sheriff Gary McFadden has been willing to inform ICE that he has undocumented individuals in his custody, he has been unwilling to hold them longer than 48 hours because he said to do so would be to break the law. And when you spoke with Tom Homan this week, Joe, he was not impressed with that excuse.
It's just ridiculous. If you care about the safety and security of your community, give us that public safety threat. Let us do our job.
McFadden has also not been notifying, as we've said, that these individuals will be released after that 48 hours, while other sheriffs around the state have complained that they have been notifying ICE, and yet ICE doesn't come and pick them up. So now the North Carolina House is getting into the act. They passed a bill this week that would require cooperation with ICE. Joe, what exactly would that bill accomplish?
So the speaker says this basically closes a loophole that exists in the past detainer law that it kind of clarifies that sheriffs are to call ICE, and it clarifies the process in which that call should be made. Now, we'll see. It passed with one Democrat voting in favor of it, Carla Cunningham from Charlotte. So they don't have a supermajority, but it's close to being able to override a potential veto from Governor Josh Stein. But, you know, we'll see if Cunningham keeps her position.
So these sheriffs in other counties who do inform ICE that after 48 hours they're going to release these people and that they're about to do so, and then they say that ICE never comes and picks them up, that's not just anecdotal evidence from a couple of sheriffs scattered around the state. Data from Syracuse University shows that while U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has increased the number of detainers, orders to keep these people in jail for 48 hours by 72% nationwide, fewer individuals are being taken into ICE custody. In North Carolina, 447 detainers have been issued since Inauguration Day on January 20th, and between that day and February 16th, but only 53 people, 12%, were taken into custody by ICE. Nationwide, that figure is 14%. Stephanie Arteaga, an immigrant advocate with the Carolina Migrant Network, says that the bill currently under consideration in the General Assembly, if passed, would cause that number to rise.
ICE does not have the capacity to travel from Charlotte area to the Triad to the Triangle, picking people up. There's not the capacity, there's not the bandwidth, there's not the funding, either from the feds or from local sheriffs.
And Mecklenburg County Democratic Representative Jordan Lopez, he believes that the bill violated the due process clause of the Constitution.
I was requiring sheriff's departments across the state to hold individuals who may otherwise be eligible for release good policy. It requires violating people's rights, spending taxpayer dollars to do so in the process, and it also opens up the state for costly lawsuits.
So, Julian, if this bill passes, I would guess it would likely be vetoed by Governor Josh Stein. Tell me, would it be when I ask you the question? And would the General Assembly likely be able to override that veto in the absence of a supermajority by Republicans?
Yeah, so we're expecting that Governor Josh Stein does veto the bill. However, like Joe said, with the support of Democrat Carla Cunningham from Charlotte, Republicans can have that supermajority and override that veto, and this bill could become law in the future.
Would they likely be able to? Would they have the votes without a supermajority to override that veto?
Yeah, it seems likely. People are saying that with that one vote from Cunningham that they can override the veto.
So Tom Homan, the czar of deportation, says 139,000 people have been deported during the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Many of those, like those rounded up and sent to a prison in El Salvador, were deported without due process, and some were in the country legally. Forget the impact that this is having on the rule of law. What kind of impact, Julian, is it having on the immigrant community?
Yeah, I think people... there's just a lot of fear in the immigrant community, just seeing that people are not having due process within court. I think the biggest thing too with the arrests that were happening at the courthouse as well is that a lot of these people, it causes fear within the community to be able to go to government buildings like courthouses, city halls, all of that. A lot of immigrants, they can go as they're there as witnesses, they're there as victims, plaintiffs in cases. So it's just creating a lot of fear within the immigrant community around who can be picked up during this time.
And ICE has been making these arrests or getting people at places and at times that they didn't used to do so. It's kind of a new approach. In your conversation, Joe, with Tom Homan, he told you that he wants to expand those options even more.
Victims and witnesses of crime don't want the bad guy in back in their neighborhood either. So give us access to the jail to arrest that public safety threat. It's safer for the officer. It's safer for the alien. It's certainly safer for the community.
And Sheriff McFadden has always said that moves like these don't make the community safer. They make them less safe.
People who are undocumented are victims of crime. People who are undocumented also witness crimes.
He has said repeatedly that actions like those being taken by ICE make people in the community less likely to come forward as witnesses, as victims of crime for fear of arrest, which makes the community at large less safe. And now he says he is working on a policy which makes the community, a policy that for federal arrest at the county courthouse like those that occurred last week. So do you have any details on the policy he's working on, Joe? Or Julie?
No, and I'm curious. I'm just curious, like, is there going to be teeth in it? Like, what does that mean, a policy? Is ICE going to give it any attention? So no, we need to learn more about that. I think that, you know, it certainly sent a message to four arrests that happen outside the courthouse that this is likely going to happen again. I think a policy is definitely, you know, a good thing to have, but is it going to be enforced? What's it going to say? What are, you know, these are the questions we need to find out.
Meanwhile, Julian, Senator Tom Tillis has labeled 9 counties in the state, including Mecklenburg, as sanctuary jurisdictions, which he says do not cooperate with ICE. Why did he feel it necessary to publish that list?
Yeah, so this list came Monday night. It was a map of basically 9 counties within the state. Mecklenburg County, Guilford County, Wake County, big counties that have Democratic sheriffs that are not cooperating, quote unquote, with ICE. And so he posted it Monday night, and it came right after President Trump signed an executive order kind of directing the Attorney General and the Department of Homeland Security to publish a list of jurisdictions that are not cooperating with ICE.
So what will it mean for those 9 counties? Mecklenburg, Buncombe, Watauga, Forsyth, Guilford, Orange, Chatham, Durham, Wake. What will it mean for those counties?
Yeah. So basically, this executive order will kind of publicize that they're not cooperating with ICE, and then it will kind of lead to future warnings to tell them that they are in violation and that they are not complying. Tillis also said, I spoke with his office this week, that he plans to introduce legislation to hold these jurisdictions accountable, but there's really no word on what that means, holding them accountable.
Finally, the North Carolina House is considering a new bill that could increase felony charges for individuals unlawfully present in this country, particularly those who have prior federal immigration convictions. Some believe the bill would be discriminatory and unconstitutional. On what basis?
Yeah, so basically, being undocumented in the United States is a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. And it also has to do with due process and equal protection rights. I think the biggest thing here is, if you're charged with one felony and you now, because you're undocumented, you are charged with a higher level of a felony, that really isn't considered equal protection, and that really is a part of due process. So immigrant advocates are saying that this bill is discriminatory, it's unconstitutional, because there's not equal protection for everybody.
Okay. Mecklenburg County's Democrats elected a new leader last weekend, Wesley Harris. He defeated Drew Cromer, who many party members were upset with because of his spending priorities and allegations that he neglected African-American voters. Harris received 76% of the vote. We can call that a landslide victory, I guess. The other thing local Democrats were upset with their former leader was voter turnout. He had promised that he would increase Mecklenburg's historically dismal turnout, but did not. And that is what Wesley Harris focused on when he spoke with WFAE.
It is turnout, and organizing these areas that we've seen it lagging in turnout. The bad news is we haven't been able to figure that out in a while, but the good news is we know where the problem is.
Mary, haven't they known where the problem is for some time, or is this some sort of new Gestalten awareness?
It seems like it's been pretty evident for a while. You know, I think one of the big things that Wesley Harris has said coming into this is that he learned a lot from his statewide race last election cycle, that he sort of is able to pick up on strategies that were working and not working within other county parties and can sort of bring that wealth of new knowledge into Mecklenburg. That being said, it's still, you know, a steep hill to climb. Drew Cromer was able to deliver on record fundraising. He was also able to fulfill his promise to bring in a lot more professional staff, and it didn't move the needle in 2024. So, you know, Wesley Harris is going to have to figure out what the next strategy is while also bringing together a pretty fractured party. He talked a lot at the convention in his acceptance address about the need for more civil discourse within the party, being a better listener, and also really emphasized the need to connect with the community, not just during election cycles, but in off years too, so that people don't feel like they're just being, you know, harassed for their vote.
Did he detail any of his plans to increase voter turnout?
He's been pretty mum on details thus far.
Okay. Town of Matthews, no secret here, they're unhappy with the current versions of the transit plan because it makes the Silver Line train to that town unlikely. And like the northern towns in the past, they don't like the idea of having to pay a 1 cent sales tax for transit if they don't get a train. Matthews proposed this week that the Metropolitan Transit Commission study a different funding split for that tax, and the commission took a vote. Mary, what was the outcome?
Matthew's resolution was pretty handedly voted down. This was something that sort of got a new burst of energy in the last few weeks when Representative Tricia Cotham introduced her version of the sales tax referendum authorization in Raleigh, because her bill didn't put the 40% cap on rail. It just put a cap on general public transit spending. There was sort of a window for opportunity, but based on this MTC meeting, there's not really a lot of appetite locally for delving into, at least for now, what that new cap would open up for Matthews.
So the current plan puts 40% of the sales tax revenues would go to roads, 40% would go to trains, 20% would go to buses, and that would not likely generate enough revenue to run the Silver Line train to Matthews. That is why Matthews proposed a different cap for the trains. They're proposing spending 45% of sales tax money on rail in hopes that it would allow them to have a train. That doesn't seem like a big deal, 5%. Why was the Transit Commission opposed, Joe, to studying the idea, not to passing it, just looking at it?
I think there's kind of a fear right now, too, of rocking the boat. We got crossover deadlines next week. It's been pretty well established, 40-40-20, with the exception of Representative Cotham's bill, which is kind of 40-60. So, you know, I think there would have been quite a few stories written had they passed that resolution. And I don't know if it would have helped their chances in Raleigh.
Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio kind of agrees with you. Here's how she reacted to the proposal.
I think having even a conversation around an additional scenario, I think will confuse the public after all the work that staff has done on that. And I think that would be unfair to all the public engagement work that's already taken place.
Of course, Matthews Mayor John Higdon, who is leading the opposition to the current plan, had a different take on his town's proposal.
I'm a little frustrated that we're saying we have to do this because we've done a lot of work on this. This is a 100-year decision. And yes, I'm incredibly frustrated because every town in the county is getting what they want except for Matthews.
So this is a carbon copy of the argument made by the northern towns when they thought they weren't getting the red line. And there was great fear and trepidation about them getting together, Cornelius, Huntersville, Davidson, and saying no to any proposal in November. Is Higdon wrong? And does he have less political clout than the northern towns?
Well, there are more people who live in the northern towns than live in the town of Matthews. And what was once significant unanimous opposition to the plan from the town of Matthews now is kind of indifference in terms of the board. Like, three members now are no longer opposed to the plan. I think that there will be a lot of people who vote no, who live in the town of Matthews. I don't know if that is enough to sway to keep people in Charlotte up at night who support this. However, if we start to see more groups come out opposed to it, especially, you know, if as these community engagement sessions like the Transit Town Hall that took place, if people are really against this, then Matthews' voting bloc does become important. So, you know, all this is a great problem to have. Right now, we don't have any guarantee there will be a referendum this fall. And next week, by the end of next week, we might know the answer for sure.
And it should be noted that all the members of the Metropolitan Transit Commission voted no on this proposal, except for the mayor of Matthews, John Higdon. Former Charlotte City Attorney Patrick Baker was suddenly forced out in October. WFAE reported at the time that it was due in part to his decision to fulfill a public records request we made. The city never announced any action or departure, but in December they announced that they would hire Anthony Fox to fill Patrick Baker's shoes on an interim basis. That Anthony Fox, 1X, is no relation to the former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox, 2Xs. This week, the Charlotte Observer reported that this cost the city. Mary, fill us in.
Yes, so we were able to kind of piece together through public records request that Patrick Baker was paid a little over $230,000 on his way out the door. Part of that was about 50% of his salary. The rest was payout for unused sick and vacation leave. And this suggests, based on the terms of his employment contract, that he was ultimately fired without cause. His contract stipulated that he get that money if he was fired without cause, and get no money if he either resigned or was fired for good cause.
Okay, so the contract, that was my question, because he was an at-will employee who they could correct, dismiss for no cause at any time, but the contract stipulated you get the money if we do it, whether you have cause or not, without cause. It's stipulated.
Correct.
Okay. Has this revelation ruffled any feathers?
Not so far, no.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about some change up at the state level on the election board, some federal cuts and what they're doing locally to individuals and to non-NGOs, public service organizations, and more. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Julian Berger is with us. He's WFAE's race and equity reporter. Zach Turner, our climate reporter from WFAE News, also here. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV. We know that earlier the General Assembly decided to remove yet another power from the governor's office, the governor's ability to appoint members to the state election board, instead deciding to give that power to State Auditor Dave Boliak, who just by happenstance happens to be a Republican. Governor Stein sued, and a lower court ruled in his favor. That was overturned this week by the State Court of Appeals, a ruling that Governor Stein is calling, quote, a threat to our democracy and the rule of law. The order was unanimous by the appeals court. Stein says it doesn't bode well for the fight over the Supreme Court seat between the person with the most votes, Allison Riggs, the incumbent Democrat, and the Republican challenger, Jefferson Griffin, who's trying to have thousands of votes thrown out. So Stein says the Supreme Court should not let the ruling stand. What are the chances, Joe, of that happening? And when might they or might they take the case?
I don't know about this one. We'll see. The Supreme Court has been issuing quite a few partisan rulings. This could be a this dramatic overhaul of the Board of Elections could stand. You know, it's been like, what, 100 years since the governor did not control the Board of Elections?
Let me ask this. The governor is a Democrat. Would he have appointed Democrats to the board? Well, Mr. Boliak is a Republican. He's obviously appointed already Republicans to this board. So it would have been a Democratic majority had the governor kept that power.
Yeah, it would have been what it is yesterday, 3-2 Democrat to Republican, because I think it's two Democrats, two Republicans, and then the governor gets to pick that fifth member. But so now Senate it is 3-2 Republicans.
Senate Leader Phil Berger, who was named a defendant in that case, said, quote, Governor Stein is desperately grasping to keep a partisan stranglehold on the Board of Elections, and the authority of the state auditor's office is well equipped to refocus the board's mission and restore trust in our elections. Why, flipping it to Republican influence, is that restoring trust to our elections? Simply because the governor's a Democrat, and the auditor is the same party as Mr. Berger?
What Republicans will tell you is that there have been a number of controversies at the Board of Elections, whether it's voter ID or the Allison Riggs Jefferson Griffin with the voter maintenance in that database, that having a Republican in charge, in their view, will settle these issues and settle them in a way to their liking.
So they wasted no time. As you mentioned, yesterday, State Auditor Dave Boliak appointed three members to the Board of Elections, all Republicans, made from a list of nominees provided by the state party chair of each of those two political parties. They submitted their list, the Republicans did. It's Francis DeLuca from Wilmington, Stacey Eggers from Boone, who was already serving on the board, and Bob Russo of Catawba County, former member of the North Carolina Senate. And the Democrats, one of the Democrats on the board, also has been on the board prior to this. Will there be an immediate impact? Will we notice something in the immediate future?
That remains to be seen. Certainly, you know, there could be a change for executive director with the Republicans in charge now. There, in a month, the local county boards of elections will all change to Republican majority as well. And I think it kind of remains to be seen how this impacts the Allison Riggs Jefferson Griffin. You know, the State Board of Elections submitted that their plan for curing ballots, and certainly they've been kind of not necessarily on Riggs's side, but against Jefferson Griffin's arguments. Will a new state board direct the staff members to take action as benefits Griffin? That could be something we see. This will be a pretty big story. Also, maybe just minor things like, you know, the State Board of Elections has, you know, approved student IDs for the absentee for showing her ID at the ballot. Will they rethink some of those policies along those lines? They've also approved voter exemption forms. So if you don't have an ID, will they change the policies around that? So, you know, there's a lot of different parts of election law that could be changed in the coming months.
So, Mary, you reported this week that Charlotte area nonprofits believe Trump administration cuts may open significant service gaps for their organizations, and that includes Roof Above, organizations like Roof Above, which serves about 1,200 people every single day. How will these cuts impact these organizations and the services they provide?
Yeah, so in some ways, it's a direct impact. For example, you mentioned Roof Above. They have paused entries into what they call their Continuum of Care program, which provides young adults dealing with homelessness with rental assistance. Roof Above has traditionally gotten money from HUD to fund that program, but now they're unsure if they'll get a new round of funding, so they've paused new intakes into that program. For other organizations, the impacts are less direct, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. A lot of these nonprofits don't necessarily get a ton of federal money, but they do get sizable state or local grants. And so if those state and local agencies get their federal money cut off, then that trickles down to the nonprofits. So really just a lot of uncertainty. uncertainty right now, especially as a lot of groups head into budget season. They're sort of trying to figure out how to, you know, make sure they've got an adequate backup plan in place to keep their work going, even if they don't get the money that they usually get.
Some of the money already approved by Congress, and we should be clear here, the money is approved by Congress, not by the executive branch. But since Trump took office, that money has yet to be dispersed. So I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that this means that some of these organizations have been feeling the pinch for a while now.
A little bit, yes. So I think the example you're referring to that we reported on this week was another Roof Above case. So they typically get $40,000 to $90,000 from FEMA to help fund their emergency shelter. That contract expired at the end of April, but FEMA had not reached out to them about instituting a new contract. Until a new contract is instituted, they can't draw down any money, even though they were awarded a new round of funding a few months ago. So again, you know, it's the hope, Roof Above told us, is that the new contract will eventually come. But with all the disruptions at FEMA, they still haven't gotten anything. And they said, you know, they spoke to Congresswoman Alma Adams' office, who told them FEMA has not dispersed all the money that Congress signed off on. And they really can't say definitively when or if FEMA will. So
it's time now for the Zach Turner Show. He's been waiting for the entire program to say anything, and now is your shot, Zach. The effect of these cuts is also being felt by area universities. We spoke on this program to two researchers at UNC Charlotte this week who had funding for a project that was supposed to go for 3 years, and they were a third of the way into it. They had that funding eliminated and will possibly result in limiting future employment for prospects for some of the students working on their project, and this is the case for other projects around the state and around the country. Tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is kind of coming from all sides from these universities, because they're getting this from contracts that they've got, or like grants that they're receiving from the CDC, the Federal Highway Administration. They're getting it from even other universities where they're like subcontractors on some of these projects. And so it's been chaotic. It's been a situation that's been evolving every single day, where they're receiving new information about what grants are getting terminated, which ones have stop work orders. And then they're getting it the other way as well, where the courts are also rescinding some of these terminations. So folks that had stopped can now start working again. And so it's been chaotic and really uncertain for a lot of these universities.
Jose Gomez is the dean of the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. As federal grants are cut, he says opportunities for research may become rarer. In fact, even the threat of cuts can be detrimental.
Got students who were connected to NSF projects that we're looking at mosquitoes and malaria prevention and new designs for housing in remote parts of the world like the African continent. Those trips are on hold right now because the funding climate's a little bit uncertain.
He referenced the NSF, that's the National Science Foundation. How much talk is there among researchers there and elsewhere about these cuts and what they might ultimately do to the United States standing in the world as a leader in research and development?
That's a good question. I think it's on everybody's mind. And I can use UNC Chapel Hill as kind of an example. They've got thousands of projects going on, thousands and thousands of grants that they're working on. Right now, I think 89 have been terminated. This is the figure I have as of yesterday. I believe. And so it's a smaller percentage, but it still like represents millions of dollars of research, millions of dollars that they thought they were going to have at their disposal for these projects that they no longer have access to. And some of these projects might be in their second or third year. They might be halfway through them, and now it's uncertain if they'll be able to finish them. You know, this project, like this is a good example, the one that Gomez was talking about at UNC Charlotte. This is a project where they were going to Tanzania. Last year, they were able to take students. This year, it's just going to be the researchers, the faculty, and they're not going to be able to bring students. And those graduate students rely on those research projects to finish their education.
There's also some mis or disinformation going around about FEMA's recent decision about Hurricane Helene disaster relief in the state. It's coming from liberal social media pundit Brian Tyler Cohen, who's a sensation on TikTok and Instagram and other places. He says that Donald Trump denied the state's request for FEMA relief from the hurricane and called that decision unwarranted. And that isn't exactly accurate. So what is?
Yeah, not quite. So the situation before was that FEMA was going to reimburse, do this like 100%, not reimburse, it was 100% match for debris removal and emergency operations relating to Helene in North Carolina. That was for 6 months. Governor Stein wanted to extend it another 6 months, or at least another 3 months, if possible. FEMA has said that that's not what they're going to do, but they're not completely eliminating the match. It's going to move to a 90% match, which is still higher than the usual 75% match, but it still represents a significant amount of money for North Carolina, about $200 million if they go from 100% match to a 90% match.
Wow. Wildfires continue to be a problem, and now Governor Stein has extended the state of emergency for Western North Carolina for an additional 30 days and includes 34 counties, among them Mecklenburg, Cabarrus, Gaston, Iredell, Rowan, Catawba, and Union counties. What does that mean for these areas?
Well, it means that, one, we're in a bit of a drought, moderate drought. It's been very dry. Being in a state of emergency gives us access, gives the state ability to mobilize resources that it might not otherwise be able to do, state, federal resources, gives us access to funding in the event that we need to, recover some costs when responding to things like wildfires. And this is all in response to what has been a very exceptional wildfire, spring wildfire season. We have already exceeded the number of acres burned that we have seen in like the past decade of wildfire seasons.
So we need some good news, and I'm going to count on you to bring it. Bird flu. Evidently, bird flu, which is still a major problem in other parts of the country among poultry and cattle and humans, North Carolina's poultry flock seems to be avian influenza free. How did we accomplish that?
Relying on your climate reporter for good news is, that's a gamble. The poultry industry in North Carolina is a huge priority. That's like our number one cash crop right there. So this is a $1 million industry for North Carolina. They took it very seriously, and we've had fewer incidents of infection in our poultry barns as opposed to some other states where they have seen potentially billions of birds lost. I think we had about 3 million chickens lost during some incidents, which is a lot, but not, when you look at the total population, the total number of poultry farms we have in the state.
Joe, in 2019, Charlotte bought some new buses, electric buses. They were touted as the future. That future has now passed. They were expected to have a life expectancy of 12 years. They didn't last 5 because you reported this week that some of those buses were put up for auction. Why?
Yeah, the Proterra buses that they purchased and had a big press conference and rolled them out. And the company went bankrupt. And when the company went bankrupt, cities across the country, including Charlotte, because we had them at the airport, we're left struggling because when these buses broke down, they didn't have access to replacement parts, or, they didn't all of a sudden have the ability to order additional replacement buses. So the city was stuck with 5 buses that essentially did not work anymore or were no longer reliable. They didn't trust them. So they had to put them up for auction.
Are they likely to find any buyers for buses you can't repair?
They did. They found, I don't know why, but 4 people bought these buses. They paid less than you'd pay for a car for them. I think one of the buses sold for $4,000. So if you see a former airport bus as an Airbnb in a backyard somewhere, you'll know the backstory behind that.
They could be good for scrap metal, I guess,
Yeah.
At least they're concerned about repairs and maintenance, something that seemed to be a challenge a couple of years ago. I only have a couple seconds left, Julian, but tariffs and the threat of tariffs are threatening the toy supply for Christmas, among other things, but it's also threatening the Latino community and foods that they bring in from their native countries. Tell us more about that in less than a minute.
Yeah, so a bunch of foods from Latin America are currently being tariffed at 10%. So we have a lot of local food distributors who specialize in foods from Latin America that are really feeling this impact, and they're losing their profit margins. They're taking in these prices in order to not affect people at the grocery store that are buying these Latin American foods.
And finally, and perhaps less importantly, the Spectrum Center has been involved in a series of upgrades over the last couple of summers. They unveiled the next wave called the Reimagined Spectrum Center project. What are concert goers and Hornets fans in for, Joe? 15 seconds.
The biggest thing they'll see is new seats, and there will be more seats in the lower bowl. So enjoy next time you see one of your favorite artists, like Weezer. I know you're a big Weezer fan, Mike, at the Spectrum Center.
Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, Mary Ramsey for the Charlotte Observer, Julian Berger and Zachary Taylor both work for us, WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.